Hello, this is Universal Soul Love.
This is Detective David Love.
And Dr. Lana Love.
Welcome to our show. Today we're very pleased to have our special guests,
Joe and Nancy McMonigal from the Munro Institute. Today we're recording live from the Munro Institute in Virginia, USA.
We've been here all week. We're doing the, Lana and I are doing the Gateway Voyage program, and we've been having a great time here.
We're discovering new spiritual levels of our consciousness. Very exciting. And we're very lucky to have Nancy and Joe McGonigal from the Munro Institute to talk to today to tell us more about the Institute, the program, and their lives together and how that's made a difference to our world.
Yeah, welcome to our show, Nancy. We've had you on the show before, and we've had Joe on as well. And we've had a great interview with you in the past, and we're just very honored to be here with both of you today, and we're very just so happy to be at the Institute. We're having such a great time.
Well, thanks for coming all this distance. It's a couple of miles from here to Australia.
Just a few.
Right.
Yeah. Or shall I say kilometers, I suppose.
All the way from the other side of the world, but it's definitely worth it.
Yeah.
You arrived on a plane, you don't necessarily have to take one back. You can always fly back.
Yeah, now that you've learned all the techniques,
right.
Basic techniques that we offer, you can just zip home.
Of course, we should tell our listeners the Munro Institute is world renowned for their studies on consciousness and the ability to go to places in your consciousness that you haven't gone before.
It's like being an explorer. Bob Munro, who started this institute, was best known for his out-of-body experiences, and I think we covered this probably in the first interview
with you.
And so this institute has been here for over 40 years, and we have probably trained 40, 50,000 people. We're not really quite sure of the number, but we know that we have reached millions with his hemisync process. Again, teaching you, which you all have been doing, is getting into these targeted, expanded states of consciousness. So have you had a good time?
We really have, and you know, the relationships we've created here just...
It's all part of it as well.
It really is.
A very important part.
The people that we've met are just fantastic. And there's so many, it reminds me so much of the Rosicrucian Lodge that I belong to, because everybody's basically a professional of some sort. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got engineers and doctors and therapists. And when I was in my Rosicrucian Lodge, we had an astrophysicist, a diplomat, which I'm not really, you know, that's not even the point. But the point being is that...
All walks of life.
Yeah, all walks of life, because there was a time when this was this sort of, the supernatural was a taboo subject for doctors, lawyers, and engineers. And
right. Just for us fringe people.
Fringe people,
on the fringe, right?
And what I love about Robert is that he's made, you know, he's accurately noted all his out-of-body experiences and, you know, created a very scientific way of looking at it and recreating it, which is amazing. And amazing to have. I must say, I didn't have an out-of-body experience. I got close to it. I got a whiff of what it might be like. And I guess the whole meaning of this as well is to realize that we are more than our bodies. That just expands our horizon.
That would be the bottom line. You're more than your physical body, and it's not just a belief, you get to experience without dying.
I've always told people that one of the amazing things about Bob Munro is when he wrote his books, that he could take his experiences and actually write about them and put them out in a publication where you could understand exactly what it was he was going through, how he could have some of those experiences and explain them to the point you could understand them. It's just remarkable to me, because I have an experience every now and then, and it's like no way I can explain the experience. I'm lost for words. It's just an amazing thing.
I was at a loss for words when I read his books. I think they had the biggest impact any books ever had on me. And so Robert's your stepfather.
That's right.
He's probably, I said before in our interview with you that he was my idol, basically.
He was an extraordinary person. Mm. He really was.
Yeah, unfortunately, 10 years ahead of himself. we used to joke about it because he'd come up with an idea, and of course it would. He came up with an idea where he was going to have a 24-hour news service, I remember, at the cable company. And the way it worked is he's going to tape an entire half hour of the local news, what exactly was going on. And then he'd send that that reel around to other stations, and everybody would play that same half hour over and over for 4 hours, and then a new reel would replace it.
Yeah, it's now called CNN.
It's now called CNN. But back in those days, it completely flopped because he couldn't get the reels made in time to get them out, and created a real problem for him. So always 10 years ahead of himself.
Yeah. One of the things he did, he had a piece of land that had water, just, it was like an aquifer. I don't know how many gallons a minute were coming out of it.
It was 127 gallons a minute.
I mean, it was amazing.
It was huge.
And he said, now this is back in the 70s, I believe it was. He said, you know, it's too bad we can't bottle this. But who is going to buy bottled water?
Really?
Yeah, nobody will
bottle
water.
Nobody will buy bottled water.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But Bob was a businessman primarily. He actually
yes,
worked.
He
worked in radio, and
yes.
He actually worked. Didn't he provide the? He created the music for The Shadow.
Well, he actually wrote scripts, and he was a VP at RKO, and
really?
in New York.
Wow!
So he was a New York businessman, flat out, until all this happened to him, put him on the fringe.
Right.
But he didn't want to be on the fringe. He had a very scientific bent, and he was a businessman, and he wasn't going to go into the, how do you put it, the beads and sandals
part. Yeah, the beads and sandals
of,
part,
you
yeah.
know, trying to give this a religious meaning or a spiritual meaning or anything like that. He just wanted to know, what is this really all about? And how can I help other people with this now?
Right.
And that's how it all got started, was with the out-of-bodies. And he thought he was going crazy.
You know, I've had out-of-body experiences, and I saw a psychiatrist when I thought I was crazy, too, and they assured me, they said, this is normal, this is what happens between the waking and sleep state, it's called a hypnagogic image,
right.
And I go, that doesn't mean anything to me, that's a name, and, you know.
So you married one so you could have your own car.
Which actually brings us to the whole idea of soulmate couples.
Right,
and because what we wanted to ask the two of you, what we didn't get to last time, we talked all about the Munro Institute, but about your relationship, because I guess you're like the dream team of consciousness, consciousness dream team.
I mean, this is a bit unprecedented, isn't it? I mean, you two have never done an interview together? Nancy McMonagle, of the executive director of the Munro Institute, and Joseph McMonagle.
You must be the most well-known remote viewer on the planet.
Not just the most well-known remote viewer, I think.
Yeah, you guys have a first.
Yeah. Yes, this is an amazing...
I think that's
I don't think we've ever done a joint interview.
Oh, we did, yeah, Japan.
Oh, yeah,
in Japan. But
that
was
in
for
Japanese,
television.
So.
It was in Japanese.
So how?
But this is actually at the Munro Institute. So
that's
what
right. We're right here in the lunchroom of the Munro Institute that the employees run.
So can I ask you, would you have met around or connected around the issue of consciousness by any chance? And spiritual experiences?
Yeah, I think you could say that. She was my trainer.
Oh, wow.
It was not my first gateway. Back then, all they had was gateways. And guidelines. So I did repetitive gateways because they were a great vacation. They were very relaxing for me in some of the more stressful periods of my career. But
I can imagine.
So I would come to gateways. But I had her as my last trainer, my last gateway. And I was going through a separation and divorce of my second wife at the time, and that was a big problem because when I retired from the military, she had this expectation that I was going to, I think, move to St. Louis and buy an apartment building and basically give a apartment to each of her sisters and her grandmother and her mother, and then I was going to be the caretaker of the apartment building. And I said, no, you got that all wrong. I'm building a cabin in the woods. I'm going to live in the cabin in the woods down in Virginia. And so she's very happy in St. Louis, I hope.
Oh, that's good.
So we're actually told that the Gateway program creates a lot of weddings and marriages because...
They call them Monromances.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Monromances, yeah.
Yeah.
Because, of course, a lot of people that come together are of a very similar ilk.
Exactly.
And
yeah,
right. As we were talking about, the bonding between the participants is fantastic anyway because we all have very similar interests. And and of course, Joe, if we can just briefly talk about remote viewing for listeners that don't know about remote viewing, what's the best way of describing it?
Well, remote viewing is the capacity to be able to describe something that's completely remote from you. It doesn't matter about distance or time or any of that sort of thing. It can be in the past, the future, the present. It's the ability to describe something in great detail that you have no idea what it is, because the predominant reason it's called remote viewing is it's a protocol that was designed and written by Stanford Research Institute International that states what the difference is between being psychic and being a remote viewer is the remote viewer has to be completely, totally blind to the target. That's double blind. And anyone in the room with a remote viewer has to be double blind, because we recognize that there's lots of communication that takes place without, you know, verbalization.
It's still very much a psychic function, isn't it?
Talent. It's like forcing someone to be psychic.
Oh, okay.
Because there's no hints, no person that can give them a hint, because no one in the room knows what the targets are. And so it's a way of harnessing psychic functioning in a totally blind way that forces the person to produce psychic information. Mm-hmm. One of the interesting things is all the people who participate in remote viewing then become psychic by default, because no one knows what the target is. So we'll have circumstances where the monitor may ask exactly the right question that's needed to be asked of the psychic to produce the result that's necessary. Or the analyst, for instance, who is analyzing the remote viewing, might ask a question that answers the problem. So everybody's being psychic. We're not exactly sure who's the most psychic, but information just flows, and we learn to harness that and use it for intelligence collection and gathering, which is remarkable.
Yeah,
spying remotely.
Spying.
Yes. So, Nancy, what was it like when you found out you had Joe, the world's foremost remote viewer?
I was unaware of it. I had no idea that, because it was private information, it was still secret. When I met him, I did not know this, and he was a participant in the program, and of course, being proper, or not so proper, whatever.
Yeah.
When we talked and whatnot, he did not share this with me. He couldn't, right?
Yeah, I couldn't tell anybody that I was a remote viewer or anything.
Not so true anymore. We've been comparing war stories.
Yeah.
I can't compare to your experiences, but anyhow, I can relate. So,
well, one of the reasons is because they decided that over the many, many years that remote viewing was being used by the government, they came to the conclusion that they really needed a defense, and no one could produce one. So I think the ultimate defense is you just release it out to the internet and let nature take its course.
Internet or the universe?
The universe.
Well, information
internet,
comes to more.
Internet's part of
right.
the universe.
Oh,
it is.
Yes.
And within 6 months, I think there were 3,000 people out there that had worked with me privately in my office. So. An office, I would add, that only had 10 people working in it given time.
That's the great part about the internet, is information tends to take on a truth of its own and a life of its own. So it
I
is
think
a,
the word truth might be an interesting choice of words to describe it.
Yeah.
So it is a good way to just let people run with it
and
let it take its course, as you said.
Right.
So
I
can you tell us what happened after that? How did things blossom?
Well, why don't you tell us?
Well, it's one of those things. I met him, and there was just this, I knew. I just knew.
Oh.
And had no idea of his talents. Oh. I just knew he was an army guy, you know. And so we got to talking and sharing stories, and it just became more and more clear. It's like, what did my mother put it? You're like two peas in a pod, is the way she put it.
So we like to talk a lot about soulmates, and of course
twin flames and twin, you know,
twin
missions.
Twin flames. Oh, I like that.
Oh,
that's
yeah,
fun.
That's cool. I like that because I told her when it appeared that we were first getting a little bit more serious. I said, well, you know, I don't want to get married a third time because this is like two 7-year marriages in a row. It's I just didn't want to do it a third time, and I couldn't stand the idea of someone else marrying her. I thought, you know, even if I was married to her for a year, it would be better than not being married to her. And that was 31 years ago.
We will have been married 32 years in November.
32 years, and you both look very happy. I mean, we're having a very good time here. There's a great energy going
on. It's hard to believe it's been 32 years.
Wow.
I mean,
it's amazing.
Time has gone by way too fast.
Yeah. So there's something about being two peas in a pond. There's something about having a certain something about the connection that really makes a soulmate romance. And what is that ingredient? Is it a mixture of your having your life's passions come together? Is it being on the same vibrational frequency? What do you think that is?
Yes.
I think very much so.
You're in alignment.
Yes.
Well, I think there is something. Plus, I'm an astrologer, and so the question often comes up, well, so what is the difference between fate and free will then? And some things, even though I'm an astrologer, and I do believe we all come in and we have certain givens, but you get to choose, or it appears that you get to choose what your options are within the givens, there seems to be a fated quality, an inner knowing, perhaps, that occurs. Or you meet somebody, and we're not necessarily talking soulmates here, but it's like, I know I have known you before. There's that resonance, right? So I suspect there are a number of us, and I don't think you ever meet anyone by accident. And that I'm including the person at the supermarket who's putting your purchases in the bag.
It's a very difficult thing, because I feel the same way. I feel like my life is often directed by my higher self, higher power, greater self, whatever you want to call it.
Exactly, by whatever word.
And it's like it puts these people in your path or these opportunities in your path, and it's almost unmistakable, and it feels directed, but at the same time, there is this tremendous free will, and I think you can walk away from it, but it almost feels like you can't. So I don't know.
I happen to think that personal choice and decisions that's basically a perfect act of free will. In other words, you will do what is fated to be happening. So it's not a question of walking away. It's a question of how am I going to do it? I mean, there's just been so many synchronicities in our relationship that it's not funny. How many couples have you ever heard of that build a 5,000 square foot house together and never had an argument or a fight over it? Mm. I mean, that's unbelievable.
That's because we had division of labor.
Good division of labor. She took care of everything that is pretty, and I took care of all the stuff
structural
that you never see.
And it just flowed seamlessly together.
Worked
did,
well.
Did you, if you don't mind me getting just a little personal, if we call your relationship a twin flame or a soulmate relationship, we have our own definitions for this, but I think we have a lot of soulmates whole soul family extended whatever, but this maybe being a twin soul or something relationship, and they're known for their, a lot of twin flame couples are known for their disagreements, for having a fiery relationship.
They push each other's buttons easily.
So how was it for you starting out, or was it, did you have your,
actually, do you remember we did used to have a lot of
headbutting
of those, because mother would say, you all stop it. I said, no, we're having fun.
We're having fun,
because we would disagree about this side of that. But
it was more of a
real fiery, no.
No, it was more of a, we'd have a disagreement, but then we'd just sit down and work it out.
Right.
And plus we both have this, and I have to tell you, this is like a, I guess a more of a personal thing, but we both are of the same mind when it comes to, if you have an argument or anything like that, you just don't walk away from it. You got to finish it before you do anything else. I mean, you, if it's like you're going to bed and you get in an argument, you just don't get into bed and go to sleep.
I've heard that.
Until you have that discussion and you you solve it in some way.
Resolve it.
And yeah, we've always done that. We've it's been like an automatic thing with us.
Did you have that right away? Was that something you just developed in the course of your relationship?
We kind of started out that way.
I think
because
we started
after,
out
you know,
that way,
he had a lot of practice.
True.
And so, so I guess we can say that you're both psychic, right?
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
absolutely.
You are the psychic power couple. Really?
I think so. So she's displayed lots of psychic ability.
So I wonder whether that's sort of given your relationship an even
an intuitive edge.
Third dimensional quality where you can feel each other's nuances.
Well,
but like in any relationship, you got to really care about the other person.
For sure.
And she's my whole world. So anything else is anything else is subject to that. So
that's,
you know,
that's beautiful.
That's where it all starts with me. As with her, and anything other than that comes as a secondary and third and tertiary and that sort of thing.
Quadrupedary. And
yeah. So
Nancy's expressing great gratitude right now.
Yeah.
That's
Mike and I just feel the energy, the radiance.
You know,
we've
been through the same difficulties, I'm sure, that many couples go through at different points in life, where it, you know, it looked like at one time, you know, I lost a job and she wasn't working, or at one time she was working and lost a job and I wasn't working, whatever, but it looked like the horizon was pretty bleak. Mm-hmm. And in that case, we were, you know, totally prepared to, if we had to live in a trailer, a, you know, one-room trailer together, that's what we would have done, because that...
Yeah, I said, whether it's
the
a
relationship,
tip,
it's not...
That's the primary.
That's
thing.
It's the relationship. It's not about stuff.
Well, actually, it was this. I'll just go ahead. I was here as a director, and we were talking about the 80s, and it was not easy working for my dear stepfather. Usually working for brilliant people is not an easy course to take. Now, add to that the familial dynamic.
Yes.
And Bob, beyond being brilliant, also had a very big heart, but he could also be very difficult to work for. I'll just put it that way.
Well, that's not surprising. Like you said,
so,
that happens.
I finally said, I was talking to Joe, and I said, you know, I think it's time that I let Bob go find his man to do his work for him. Now, mind you, he was born in 1915.
Oh,
so he had old perspective, and I, after all, was female and a daughter. Whoops. So I had just gotten very frustrated and felt like perhaps he would be better off having somebody that he perhaps would resonate better with as a male in the... executive director position, whatever. So I said to him, so what do you think? If I were to resign, can we do this? Because, you know, that's my salary and all this stuff. And we both decided, yeah, if we end up living in a tent, so be it.
That was preferable to seeing her.
Yeah, because I was watching my body. I could see. And it's interesting, you know, they often say you teach what you most need to learn. Okay. And here I was running a place where we're teaching people to relax. And I'm like, And it was finally like, okay. You know, so, no, it's not magic that we perform here. We all have to learn these things. We all go through these times.
Absolutely.
But because of our relationship, it was like the support he gave me was incredible. And so, you know, I did. I turned in my resignation, and then it was 23 years later I was asked to come back.
I didn't realize you had taken such a big break from the institution.
Yeah, they call it my 23-year vacation.
23.
Yeah, well, actually, Joe and I were running our business, and I was setting up targets for him with our clients and stuff.
Oh, but, like a remote viewing business?
Right. Yeah. Well, also in astrology, so I did the astrology over here, and I interfaced with the clients, because, of course, Joe could not know anything about the targets.
Totally blind.
Had to be blind. That's part of the rules. Otherwise, you know, you can go see Mama Sita and ask her how, you know.
So this is not working for the government?
No.
Anymore.
No.
So what people would want remote viewing for?
Well, when I retired from the government job, I was hired in the lab at Stanford Research Institute. So I was working part-time out there off and on doing remote viewing for the lab. It was also their way of keeping me in the collection business for producing things when they needed them in the government. Well, at the same time, I started my own company, our company actually, called Intuitive Intelligence Applications, and it's incorporated in Virginia now for 33 years, I guess, 32 years, mm-hmm. something like that. Mm-hmm. And
Since your retirement.
Yeah.
From the Army.
And I started, that was in 1984, and we provided support to everything from businesses all over America and the world, to individuals who were, you know, looking for things, that sort of stuff. And in fact, I remember the day we started, I said, I don't know if I can make any money doing this. And she said, well, give it a year. Let's find out. And that year became two, and then three, and then four. And I wound up working for some really good clients in different states. And it worked really well, and I got paid really well for the viewing that I did. So.
And for the record, because I can hear some people going, ooh, I wonder how I can contact him. I'd like to have some done. Joe has retired from doing remote viewing targets.
Okay?
Yes, so, I just retired, in fact.
So, but
congratulations.
He trains our remote viewing programs here at the Institute.
Right.
But he's not taking clients now.
Was that your idea to have a remote viewing program? Is
that
something that grew
It was here. It was already here.
Yeah, it was.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's already here.
He, though, has upgraded it, I'll put it that way, redesigned a lot of it, and people, I think it's like 99% of the people who go through a remote viewing program here, when he says, okay, how many of you feel, on the last day, how many of you feel like you can remote view? How many people raise their hands?
100%.
At least
99%.
You may have one person or something.
One out of the group isn't quite sure.
But it's very, very effective.
It's amazing, isn't it? And it raises the question of, you know, everyone being psychic.
That's
and
right.
Everyone having the potential. And also, I mean, it's for me, it's really interesting to flirt, if you like, with the idea that consciousness does not reside in our brain, that our brain is an antenna, and our consciousness might be everywhere.
Exactly.
And that we have... in the gut.
Yes.
Investigators. Everywhere.
Investigators' intuition. It's a gut feeling. My book was the Illusion of the Body, the Body Alive Principle. And the first sort of spiritual concept that ever came to me was that we have every organ and every system and every cell, cellular memory, has consciousness. So, and it has its own intelligence and its own existence. And they all cooperate very well, usually, unless we're feeding it bad information that's going to affect it negatively. But we had Howard Martin last week from HeartMath on, and he was talking about heart intelligence. And here we are at the Monroe Institute talking about consciousness. And just my first concept was panpsychism, which is the idea that all things have consciousness, even the things we believe that are inanimate. So
everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Eric, you're not the only one who...
We might just take a quick break. Okay, welcome back to Universal Soul Love. We're here at the Monroe Institute with Nancy and Joe McMonagall, and we're talking about their lives together.
We're talking about twin flame relationships and consciousness and all sorts of great stuff here.
Conflagration.
Yeah.
What's that?
Twin flames. I see a conflagration. Isn't that what the word is?
Oh, yeah. Right. Of two flames.
More like two forest fires.
Like the Olympic fire. The Olympic flames, right?
The divine union of the masculine and feminine energy.
One of the things I wanted to address, you had said consciousness and everything. And what you don't know is part of one of the jobs I did is I did a lot of work with Professor Emeritus at Texas A&M. His name is Ron Bryan. And I targeted some particles, subquantum particles and things for him.
And you targeted particles?
Yeah, oh yeah. Doesn't matter. You can go all the way down to very small.
He had a little disc. Radiation.
It was a way of freezing, like an electron in time space, and
that he gave me, and I
didn't know what it was, and I had to explain what it was, and I said, "Well, everyone knows an electron. You can't see the nucleus of an electron. All you can see is the energy field." So, I said, "Well, this is like a symphony orchestra, with all the trimmings except." You're missing one part to the symphony orchestra. It's the part you can't see or hear. And he looked at me and he said, like, what? I said, the conductor. There's always a conductor, but you can't see him or hear him. You become involved with the whole symphony orchestra, but you don't see or hear the conductor. He said, that's exactly the best description he'd ever had of an electron. So he said, I'm going to put that in my textbooks, if you don't mind. I said, sure. So we worked together for a while in any event. And one of the things we came to the conclusion, based on the remote viewing we were doing and everything, was that we developed the belief that all things include inanimate objects, all contain subquantum particles, and the subquantum particles have intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And they decide for themselves. We don't. And so we wrote a proposal for an experiment that would prove that definitively one way or another, and went out for funding. And it turns out that this has interested two Nobel laureates who want to be there when we finally do the experiment, as well as we've gotten a lot of promises of assistance and aid from many, many of the doctoral students and postdocs that work for some of these people. And we were right on the verge of getting the rest of the funding when he developed cancer, and he's fighting that now.
Sorry to hear that.
There is actually an experiment that we've drawn up that a lot of people have interest in to try to establish one way or another whether or not that's true. People have asked me, well, how can a rock have intelligence?
That's the oldest philosophical debate.
Yeah, and
do rocks have thoughts and feelings?
My response to that is, well, of course, because that's that's what they do. They're rocks, and that's why when you try to interact with a rock and crack it with your mind, it won't crack, because it's very good at being a rock. Now, it may be that we can ask it not to be, and it'll crack. We don't know, but there may be a way of finding that out. Yeah,
well, I guess that's what they do with martial arts, yeah. I guess.
Right.
And bending spoons and cutlery, which
exactly.
You're good at doing here as well. I think in your psychokinesis MC squared program, I believe that it's almost like you, Joe here...
Joe Gallenberger, the
trainer, tells me that you sort of
You speak to the spoon itself or the utensil
and
itself
ask for permission to bend it.
Sure. Because it will. I mean, it'll bend for you.
So when you say that inanimate objects have intelligence, presumably you're talking about consciousness?
Absolutely.
What is consciousness anyhow?
I find that hard.
You have to understand that the physics of it. Mm-hmm. In the physics of reality, everything is because we have a co-creativeness about being human. It's our observation and our interaction with one another and our which you would call, I guess, a co-belief in something that causes it to just be.
Co-belief.
That's yeah.
An agreement
between all humans that we live on a planet that's partially blue and partially green and has all these things.
And this is an orange and this is an apple. And if you call an orange an apple and we get mixed up on those definitions and those meanings, things go haywire between people and societies.
There are some really interesting things that you can do to show that human perceptions have they're faulty when it comes to understanding the environment they're relating to.
Our limited belief systems.
Yeah, so, you know, personal belief systems drive a lot. Drives what we see, drives what we smell, drives what we taste.
And our superiority complex and thinking that inanimate objects have no intelligence or feelings, which we just don't know, and I don't know, but I'm open to the idea that of the possibility. I'm open to the possibility of almost anything because I just don't know. And like I said, my first spiritual theory was my awareness of panpsychism, which is just the idea that all things have consciousness. And I do believe that, although I can't... I mean, I'm an investigator. We're all investigators, all of us here. And there's things that just because you can't prove them and you can't find factual evidence, whatever that means, or it doesn't mean that it's not true or that it's not possible. And that's where the difficulty is.
I think there might be a difference here. An investigator does some real good analysis of it, whereas we create explorers here. And you can analyze whatever it is or not. In your job, you have to, because you have to come to conclusions. You have to look at the details and pay attention to patterns and whatnot. As explorers of consciousness, it's like, go out there, experience it, and come back and talk about it and so forth. But whether you're necessarily analyzing, perhaps, but as a detective, you have to, don't you? Because you're looking for a specific...
Well, you do. If I'm trying to find a missing person, the only objective is to find that missing person.
Right.
If you don't do that, then, you know...
Of course, there's we can be both explorers and observers. Mm. And you know, classically, the mindfulness, the developing mindfulness...
I love mindfulness.
...is the ability to be... observe yourself while you're exploring, and having that dual function, I think, creates that balance and that wisdom.
So it's life is about experiencing. It's about having experiences, but I guess it's also important to be the observer of those experiences. Mm-hmm. I guess we're going a little bit deep with this.
I'm very interested in what you've talked about, having a co-creativeness or a participatory quality of everything on the planet, and that raises a big question of how much responsibility do we have for what's happening that's not so good on the planet, and what do we do about it if we are all co-participators?
Well, I think that's a really interesting question, and it deserves a really good answer. And I'm not sure I have it, but I'm going to share what I think about it. For a long time I would have said, oh, no, we're responsible for everything. And we need to do something about saving the planet because it's our home. Mm. We have to learn to mitigate the destruction that we're doing and try to save as many species as possible. Mm. And in some cases, we're actually doing that. I mean, they're storing seeds up in the ice up in Iceland, you know, for their genetic qualities and whatnot. Those kinds of things are really important to do. But I think that it's a losing battle in terms of human, because I think as humans, I don't think we originated on this planet. I think that in reality, we're the remnants of perhaps it could have been an advanced civilization or one that's not quite so advanced. But certainly it was a civilization that came to this planet in a bad way, did what they had to do. And what I think occurred is they probably went through some long period of de-evolution and now have become, now have evolved back into what we call human. And as a result, we have this driving desire to get off the planet, to explore, to go other places. And I think it's part of our genetic code that we do that. And so we have no real driving need to protect the planet. We just take what we need to do what we got to do. That's my personal feeling about it.
It's interesting.
I guess I'm just going to quickly say, I think we have a very similar point of view on that, because you think in the infiniteness of time, none of this really matters. But then I heard you say earlier, it matters now, though. So our show is, we deal with the global issues all the time, and I think we've talked to you about our idea of the Super Consciousness Project and Catalyst Groups, and we've talked to Howard Martin about it. And so I'm just going to leave it at that. I don't know. I have that sort of same sort
and
of...
And hopefully, you know, if humans don't belong on this planet and they are not empathic enough towards Earth, hopefully it would be within our capacity or within our capacity to actually develop and evolve into having an empathy. Because after all, that would be dualistic to think about the Earth as not being part of our home if the whole universe this.
Well, you know, I think you're right. You're right. What we have is we do have probably multiple paths of evolution. And so there are humans on the planet that do care a great deal about what's going on with the planet. But there's a larger percentage of human that's basically walking around unaware, unconscious, and just doing whatever they got to do to meet that requirement, which is to explore, to get off the planet and go to a different star.
Nitya, sorry, I just cut you off.
No, that's
you're
quite
about
all right.
To say something.
I was just going to say, I think that's an interesting theory, and I think we did co-create all this. You know, I think that unfortunately, perhaps there's some devolution happening.
I like
which is
that
why
word.
We don't. A lot of people aren't caring, and they're trashing our planet and stuff. Not because we don't belong here, but because we've gotten greedy. We've gotten uncaring, we've gotten unempathetic, and I wish I had a more positive way of putting it. The positive part is there is a growing movement. There are more and more people who do care about taking care of Mother Earth, and hopefully we'll wake up to what we are doing.
A great awakening.
Too late.
Yes. It would be great if we could somehow protect the rest of the planet and mankind by, you know, groups of us evolving to the extent where others would evolve. You know, you've heard of the 100th monkey
effect.
Well,
in fact, I probably will mention that tonight if it comes to me when I come talking to you guys. I always mention, because it's this is how we are evolving, and by what you guys have just done here and what you're already doing in your lives, and by touching the lives of others, it's like a ripple effect.
That's right.
And the more we can affect people positively by being aware, by being conscious, by helping other people be conscious of who and what they are, then it just keeps exponentially growing.
And like Joe had said yesterday, you were giving a lecture yesterday whatever, sharing, and you said it all starts with each of us, and it does.
Yeah.
And of course, that ripple effect will continue.
That's right.
And it will continue. I understand. I don't actually understand math and physics. I mean, I'm not a science person.
But after my own heart.
metaphysics. My stuff is just concepts and theories. But but I understand that energy just keeps moving. So this ripple effect, whether it's positive or negative in the world, will just keep going until something interrupts it, if I'm not mistaken. Is that right?
Yeah,
that would make sense.
So it would keep moving.
Whatever
movement you create will keep going, just like a wave.
Yes.
In the case of the planet, what we're pretty sure is happening is that our galaxy is commingling with a second galaxy, and it's starting to do this dance, this rotational dance. So, yeah, the energy keeps moving, but it's probably moving in a circle. So it's going through and coming back. And, you know, I think there's some benefit to that. One of the things that is very obvious to me that's happening right now, it seems to be a trend that's growing, is more and more young people want to live off the grid. They want to go somewhere, build their home, put up the photovoltaics and the windmill and all that kind of stuff so that they don't have to damage the earth in any way. They want to take the actual materials from the ground of the place they bought to actually build the home. You know, they're making homes from everything from mud and stone.
Earthships.
Yeah, it's like...
It's a beautiful movement. Yeah, it's a movement that we're very interested
That's
in.
That's part of our
as well.
Mission statement is self-sustainable living and building self-sustainable living communities. And in fact, we've had quite a few group. We've had Sasha Stone from the New Earth Project on our show. We've had Michael Tellinger with the Ubuntu Movement. And we even had, I was part of an adventure series, a film project in Costa Rica not too long ago, where I met a number of people, including Christine Carlson, who helped write Don't Sweat the Small Stuff series. And yeah. We met a couple who were on not too long ago that are building a very large $50 million eco-village in Costa Rica, and they've got large investors for this. And I think that's a great movement, the New Earth movement. I think that's fantastic, like you're saying. But it's very necessary.
Absolutely.
But to go back to what I was saying before, one of the downsides of this is almost all of the photovoltaics they're using are coming out of China, and the people who are making the photovoltaics in China are basically trashing the very ecology where they're making these things, because it's extremely volatile from a chemistry standpoint and very toxic to make a photovoltaic cell. So, you know, it's almost anything we try to do to fix the problem is adding to it. So,
There are those fellows who are looking into free energy and so forth now. So
yeah,
I think that'll help a lot.
Yeah, well, I have a friend, Eric Davis, who's done 23 years of work on what's the Scotty way of pushing the...
Oh, teleportation?
No, okay. The...
Warp drive.
Warp drive.
Yeah.
He's been working on warp drive now for 20-something years. And it's not only proven it.
Sounds like Star Trek.
It does.
He's actually proven it in theory, which is very interesting. And the only difficulty he has now is he needs an unlimited power supply, equivalent to probably a small sun, to do it. But I think we're on the verge of maybe creating that too.
How exciting!
So. Yeah.
I think we will get there.
I'm sure.
And, you know, I know there's still lots and lots of problems, but I think what's really important is to hold the intention, not just to ascend for ourselves, but to hold the intention to, if you like, take as many people with us and you know,
in the end,
ascend together.
Yeah, because in the end, you can only do the best you can.
That's so exactly right.
It, you know, it's creation and destruction is just part of life, and someday we're probably not going to be here. I imagine the human race will.
Or at least in this.
In this, right.
We might come back as rocks. You know?
You don't know.
Just teasing.
Well, I don't know.
From a philosophic viewpoint, I mean, if you just look at what being human is all about, as human, almost any time in history, you can look and see what humans have been doing in terms of creativity. What I like to use as an example is the laser. It was 1975 at Sylvania when they were able to successfully go beyond the core temperature of the sun and cut steel with a light beam. In fact, 1900, we had all the materials we needed to build that very laser. The only reason we didn't is because nobody could conceptually grasp the idea of using light beams to melt steel. So, in history, every time we've invented something, we always possessed all the materials we needed to do it, whatever it is, in that particular moment in time. So, I think the only missing quantity is the concept of being able to understand that you have the capacity to do it.
To be open to
wanting to do it.
Which actually raises the question of being able to have... access to anything that you need, be it by remote viewing, being able to see things at a distance, or being able to have access to the so-called Akashic records, to all the information about the earth.
I think the answer to that is just everybody wanting to do it at the same time.
Right.
You know, being open to the idea. Instead of throwing the guy out the back window.
A group intention.
He's crazy.
Yeah. You need a group intention. Remember you... you asked me about a nullifying force field. You said, I wish we could create a nullifying force field. And I felt this presence come through me, and it was talking about positronic technology, and it was saying a nullifying force
field. And David doesn't know anything about technology like that, and it just came to David.
He said, this technology exists, but you don't have it yet, but it's basically... if a bullet or a fist were to go through this field, it would render it, it would render the energy of the object
de-energize,
neutralize
it. Yeah,
yeah, de-energize,
neutralize
it.
The energy of
he
it.
Said you
yeah.
can have this technology, you just don't have it yet. And all, you know, so I believe all things are possible. I have no idea what positrons, I guess, are anti-electrons, which is basically antimatter. I read
that would make sense.
I don't know.
Yeah, we'll have to research that, see if there's anything else.
Maybe,
so maybe,
we'll
maybe you're doing a 10-year ahead of
us. Yes. Maybe yeah. we just need to find out what it is.
Fantastic. So many great ideas.
Yeah.
And you know, I imagine in the Monroe Institute you probably have so many other ideas about, you know, other programs
right.
that you're going to...
Yes, we have a number of new programs in mind and continue on with our core course as we have it now, starting with the Gateway and then, of course, helping people get more in touch with their own information, whether you call those guides or angels or inner self-helpers, ish, as Bob used to call them, so that people don't have to depend on other people's belief systems in order to make decisions and to understand such things. How do you access the Akashic Records? Well, they're... know, get into the right state of consciousness and go do find out for yourself.
Amazing, amazing yeah. stuff. Such a exploring such amazing fields. And
the outer limits.
That's right.
There you go.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
We need another television show.
I can attest to the HemiSync technology. It's just amazing. It's like a drug. I feel like when I go under in the, what do they call it, somnambulance, where you're just catatonic. Yeah, and I come out of it, and it takes me an hour. I feel like there's this heavy blanket over me, and I feel drugged, like under
it's
anesthesia.
It's very powerful stuff.
And,
yeah.
and I did have an out-of-body experience. I actually wrote it
you
down.
Did?
It was very strange.
Here?
Here, yeah.
Oh,
I mean, I've had them in the past, very classic ones, you know, where you see
yes.
your body sleeping.
Right.
But
right.
here it was kind of funny because I found myself, it looked like in a kitchen, and there was a dark-haired boy, and there was his mother with long, dark hair. And I'm not sure why, but there was a toothbrush there, and I went to... The scene was sort of out of phase a bit, and I didn't realize that I was out of body. And I went to pick up this toothbrush, and I couldn't pick it up.
Couldn't pick it up.
And
yeah.
all of a sudden, I realized, oh, wait a minute, I don't belong here, and that's not my toothbrush, and I'm out of body, I think. So then I ended up back in my body, and, you know,
oh, that's cool.
it was sort of a black and white scene and sort of fuzzy, and I was very... Mm-hmm. disoriented, but yeah, that happens. So
we'd like to hear from any of our listeners whether anyone has seen David walking into the kitchen or bathroom
yeah.
picking up
yeah.
their
or
have you seen your toothbrush do something strange?
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you.
Well,
thank you
very much for having us on
yeah,
the show.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Really appreciated the info about your relationship, because I just wanted to come back to that, because you know, you had a lot of wisdom and going off on your own and the strength of your relationship, you know, when you left the Monroe Institute, and it's a testimony to the fact that adversity sometimes strengthens your relationship if you're
that's right
sticking together and you overcome those adversities that way. And I just really appreciated you coming forth and talking
oh,
about all of that.
And I think the other piece to that that people need to understand too is adversity, if it breaks apart the relationship, then perhaps the relationship had served its purpose.
Well, that's a very wise thing
yeah.
to say.
That's,
yeah.
That is. Yeah. Mm, the integrity of the relationship just wasn't there and it served its purpose.
Well,
it was there for a while.
Or it did what it was supposed to do, and then something happens and there's a parting of ways. That doesn't mean there has to be acrimony or anything. It can be the best of friends or whatever after, or just nice acquaintances. It doesn't have to be ugly.
And thank you for saying that, because Lana and I have both had our own, you know, we've been married before,
sure.
and, you know, we sort of struggle with that. We struggle with, Lana and I struggle with all these issues, just like everyone.
She must be human.
That's unbelievable. Who would have thought? The human condition.
Yes, we're back to the human condition.
But, no, it is lovely talking to you, and great
thank you very much,
coming
Lana,
to the Monroe
David.
Institute and actually trying it all these programs
well,
and getting to all these different
did,
states.
And obviously your eyes are sparkling, so it's working, right?
Both of you too. Just an honor to have both of you here at the same time at the Monroe Institute, and just having this interview is just a pleasure.
Well, it's been a pleasure
been
for
fun.
Us. Thank you, guys.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, well, that's it from us at Universal Soul Love. See you next time.
Bye for now.